there's one with the old brim. Welcome back to Symposium, our first second season. Tonight, in the company of the Coffin Daggers, Tara Brabazon, the Kilimanjaro Dark Jazz Ensemble, Timothy Morton, Lamont Young, Gaston Bachelard, and others whose anonymity is still the object of archaeological study. This is a program about what a symposium could be, the inevitable and permanent symposium of data, voices, recorded media, and found theory. Second first season's first program notes scribbled on a notepad with a hotel letterhead in New Orleans, the writing and the voicing and the hotel himself happening in New Orleans at this very moment. No instructions for listening, principles unlike problems are obsolete. The possibility of a public address is too sweet to be used, so I will let the files talk on my behalf. As the mouth becomes a finger that curls around the pen to write signs of exhaustion, or rather being fed up, on the hotel notepad, incapable to decide whether to move or be moved, como la garza que come lodo y limo en busca de algún gusano, or like the stain on the floor that can't decide whether it's nut or cockroach, still, hyper, undecidable, listening in all directions, buying contradictory plane tickets, memorabilia, framing frames in the style of Bruno Ganz in The American Friend.
A long-term attack on the lecture as an avenue for learning, teaching, and thinking. In such an environment, lectures are framed and abused as top-down, passive encounters that drain enthusiasm from learners. It's not the rotting vegetables from an over-eager online order from Ocado. It's not the permanent fog of aging that comes from living in Eastbourne. Actually, it's the waste of redundant software and hardware obsolete at the point of release and now cluttering our homes and our offices. All media have a suicide pact. The pattern repeats. Invention.
Sustainable capitalism might be one of those contradictions in terms, along the lines of military intelligence. Capital must keep on producing more of itself in order to continue to be itself. This strange paradox is fundamentally structurally imbalanced. Let's consider the unit of capitalism, the turning of raw materials into products. Now, for a capitalist, the raw materials are not strictly natural. They simply pre-exist whatever labor process the capitalist is going to exert on them. Surely here we see the problem. Whatever pre-exists the specific labor process is a kind of lump that only achieves definition as valuable product once the labor has been exerted on it. What capitalism makes is some kind of stuff called capital. The very definition of raw materials in economic theory is also stuff that comes in through the factory door. Again, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be sharks, or it could be steel bolts. At either end of the process, we have featureless chunks of stuff, one of those featureless chunks being human labor. The point is to convert the stuff that comes in to money. Industrial capitalism is philosophy incarnate in stocks, girders, and human sweat. What kind of philosophy? If you want a realism of the remainder, just look around you. Row upon row of big box houses waiting to be inhabited, terabyte after terabyte of memory waiting to be filled. Stockpiling is the art of the zeugma, the art of yoking things you hear in phrases such as wave upon wave or bumper to bumper. Stockpiling is the dominant mode of social existence. Giant parking lots empty of cars. Huge tables in restaurants across which you can't hold hands. Vast empty lawns. Nature is stockpiling. Range upon range of mountains receding into the distance. Rocky Flats nuclear bomb trigger factory was sited precisely to evoke this kind of mountainous stockpile. The eerie strangeness of this fact confronts us with the ways in which we still believe that nature is over there, that it exists apart from our technology, apart from history. Far from it, nature is the stockpile of stockpiles. So I ask again, what exactly are we sustaining when we talk about sustainability? at an intrinsically out of control system that sucks in grey goo at one end and pushes out grey value at the other. It's natural goo, natural value. Result? Mountain ranges of inertia, piling higher every year while humans boil away in the agony of uncertainty. Just take a look at manufactured landscapes, that ocean of telephone dials, dials as far as the eye can see, somewhere in China. A real ocean. It lies there at this very moment. So, meanwhile, despite nature, one of those essences that's beyond, despite grey goo, real things writhe and smack into one another. Some leap out because industry malfunctions, or functions only too well. Oil bursts out of its ancient sinkhole and floods the Gulf of Mexico. Gamma rays shoot out of plutonium for 24,000 years. Hurricanes congeal out of massive storm systems, fed by the heat from the burning of fossil fuels. The ocean of telephone dials mounts ever higher. Paradoxically, capitalism has unleashed a myriad objects upon us in their manifold horror and sparkling splendor. 200 years of idealism, 200 years of seeing humans at the center of existence, and now the objects take revenge. Terrifyingly huge, ancient, long-lived, threateningly minute, invading every cell in our body. When we flush the toilet, we imagine that the U-bend takes the waste away into some ontologically alien realm. Ecology is now beginning to tell us something very different. A flattened world without ontological U-bends. A world in which there is no away. When I hear the word sustainability, I reach for my sunscreen. It's October 2010. You're waiting at a bus stop. Someone else ambles up. Nice weather, isn't it? She asks. You pause for a moment. You wonder whether she is only saying that to distract you from the latest news about global warming. You decide she isn't. Yes, you say. But your reply holds something back. The awareness that for you it's not a particularly nice day because you are concerned that the heat and moisture have to do with global warming. This holding back may or may not be reflected in your tone. Mind you, she says. Oh, here it comes, you think. Funny weather last week, wasn't it? I blame global warming. We all have conversations that are more or less like that now. Just as after 9/11, objects to which we may have paid attention, an X-Acto knife, some white powder, suddenly gained a terrible significance, so in the age of global warming, the weather, that nice neutral backdrop that you can talk about with a stranger in that nice neutral backdroppy way that we might call thetic after Roman Jakobson, has taken on a menacing air. In any weather conversation, one of you is going to mention global warming at some point. Or you both decide not to mention it, but it looms over the conversation anyway, like a dark cloud brooding off the edge of an ellipsis. This failure of the normal rhetorical routine, these remnants of shattered conversation lying around like broken hammers, they must take place everywhere, is a symptom of a much larger and deeper ontological shift in human awareness, which in turn is a symptom of a profound upgrade of our ontological tools. As anyone who has waited while the little rainbow circle goes round and round on a Mac can testify. These syndromes have been going on now since as long as the Industrial Revolution began to take effect. As a consequence of that revolution, however, something far bigger and more threatening is looming on our horizon. Looming so as to abolish our horizon, or any horizon, in fact. Global warming, the consequence of runaway fossil fuel burning, as we all know ad nauseam, has performed a radical shift in the status of weather. Why? Because the world as such, not just a certain idea of world, but world in its entirety has evaporated. Or rather, we are realizing that we never had it in the first place. In other words, plays a very mean trick. It reveals that what we took to be a reliable world was actually just a habitual pattern, a collusion between forces such as sunshine and moisture and us humans expecting such things at certain regular intervals and giving them names, such as dog days. We took weather to be real, but in an age of global warming we see it as an accident, a simulation of something darker, more withdrawn, climate. As Graham Harman argues, world is always presence at hand, a mere caricature of some real object. So much for substance and accidents. Now let's think of the evaporation of world from the point of view of foreground and background, those tools of Gestalt psychology. The weather and the weather conversation provide a nice background to our daily affairs, nice to the extent that we don't pay too much attention to it. Precisely for it to be a background, it has to operate in our peripheral vision, as it were. Thus, the conversation about the weather with a stranger is a safe way to acknowledge our coexistence in social space. It's phatic, according to Roman Jakobson's six-part model of communication. That is, it draws attention to the material medium in which the communication is occurring. You know, so you talk on a microphone, check, check. You're drawing attention to the medium in which the communication is occurring. Weather conversation is drawing attention to the material medium in which your communication is occurring. You know, so you talk on a microphone, check, check. You're drawing attention to the medium in which the communication is occurring. Weather conversation is drawing attention to the material medium in which your communication is occurring. The weather as such, likewise, is a nice background phenomenon. It might loom distressingly into the foreground as a tornado or as a drought, but most often those are temporary affairs. There is a larger temporal backdrop against which they seem to occur as isolated incidents. Now what happens when global warming enters the scene? The background ceases to be a background, because we have started to observe it. Climate in general, climate is the totality of derivatives of weather events, in much the same way as inertia is a derivative of velocity. Climate as such is a beast newly recognized via the collaboration of weather, satellites, scientists, government agencies, and so on. This beast includes the sun, since it's infrared heat from the sun that is trapped by the greenhouse effect of gases such as CO2. So global warming is a colossal entity that includes entities that exist way beyond Earth's atmosphere, and yet it affects us intimately right here and now. Global warming is a prime example of what I now call a hyperobject, an object that is massively distributed in space-time, an object that radically transforms our ideas of what an object is. It covers the entire surface of the Earth and extends forwards perhaps 1,500 years into the future. Remember what life was like in 1010? The spooky thing is, we discover global warming precisely when it's already here. It's like realizing that for some time you had been conducting your business in the expanding sphere of a slow-motion nuclear bomb. You have a few seconds for amazement as the fantasy that you inhabited a neat, seamless little world melts away. All those apocalyptic narratives of doom about the end of the world are, from this point of view, part of the problem, not part of the solution. By postponing doom into some hypothetical future, these narratives inoculate us against the very real object that has intruded into ecological, social, and psychic space. If there is no background, no neutral peripheral stage of weather, but a very visible, highly monitored, publicly debated climate, then there is no foreground. Foregrounds need backgrounds to exist. So the strange effect of dragging weather phenomena into the foreground as part of our awareness of global warming has been the gradual realization that there is no foreground. The idea that we are embedded in a phenomenological life world, for instance, tucked up like hobbits into the safety of our burrow, has been exposed as a fiction. The specialness we granted ourselves as unravelers of cosmic meaning, Heideggerian Dasein, for instance, falls apart, since there is no meaningfulness possible in a world without a foreground-background distinction. Worlds need horizons, and horizons need backgrounds, which need foregrounds. When we can see everywhere, when I can Google Earth the fish in my mum's pond, in her garden in London, that's actually not a great picture of it, but there are Google Maps images where I can see the fish in her fish pond. The world, as a significant bounded horizoning entity, disappears. World turns out to be an aesthetic effect based on a kind of blurriness, an aesthetic distance. This blurriness derives from an entity's ignorance concerning objects. Only in ignorance can objects act like blank screens for the projection of meaning. Red Sky at Night, Shepherd's Delight, is a charming old saw that evokes days when shepherds lived in worlds. Worlds bounded by horizons on which things occurred, such as red sunsets. The sun goes up, the sun comes down, goes down. Of course, now we know it doesn't. So Galileo and Copernicus tore big holes in that particular notion of world. Likewise, as soon as humans know about climate, weather becomes a flimsy, superficial appearance that is a mere local representation of some much larger phenomenon that is strictly invisible. You can't see or smell climate. Given our brain's processing power, we can't even really think about it all that concretely. You could say then that we still live in a world, only massively upgraded. True, but now world means significantly less than it used to. It doesn't mean significant for humans, or even significant for conscious entities. A simple experiment demonstrates plainly that world is an aesthetic phenomenon. The idea of world depends on all kinds of mood lighting and mood music, aesthetic effects that by definition contain a kernel of sheer ridiculous meaninglessness. It's the job of serious Wagnerian worlding to erase the trace of this meaninglessness. So standard ecological criticism depends upon different concepts of world. Indeed, it derives this concept from philosophical thinking about climate, for instance, in the proto-nationalist thinking of Humboldt and Herder, or from biological racism that says I'm white because I was born in a northern climate. This is what Darwin's Descent of Man is all about, right? It's like, I'm only white because 3 million years ago somebody thought that was sexy, and maybe they only had one choice. World is what is created or enframed, Gestell, by equipment, techne. This definition has given rise to the now pervasive doctrine of worlding, whereby cultural artifacts embody the world in various ways. To a hammer, everything looks like a nail, as they say. Now, for a kickoff, there are many reasons why, even if world were a valid concept altogether, it shouldn't be used as the basis for ethics. Consider only this. Which ducking stools constitute a world, just as much as hammers? There was a wonderful world of witch ducking in the Middle Ages. Witch ducking stools constituted a world for their users in every meaningful sense. There is for sure a world of Nazi regalia. Just because the Nazis had a world doesn't mean we should be preserving it. So the argument that it's good because it's constituted in a world is, to use the technical term, bogus. The reason not to interfere with the environment because it's interfering with someone's or something's world is nowhere near a good enough reason. It might even have pernicious consequences, so I'm afraid we must part with Donna Haraway, whose ethics insists that non-humans are worthy of our care and respect because they constitute worlds. They are in the worlding business. I part company with Haraway here, just as she parts company with me, since she thinks that what I'm proposing by contrast is exterminism, getting entities oven ready for destruction. To which I reply, how can you get an entity that doesn't exist ready for destruction? The second area of concern is historical, namely the way in which current ecological crises, such as global warming and the sixth mass extinction event, have thrown into sharp relief the notion of world. Now up here we've got Earthrise on the left, and then more radically the pale blue dot, which is the picture, the last picture of Earth from Voyager as it left the solar system. It is as if humans are losing their world and their idea of world, including the idea that they ever had one, at one and the same time. This is at best highly disorientating. In this historical moment, the concept world is thrown into sharp relief by circumstances demanding conscious human intervention. Working to transcend our notion of world is important at this moment. Like a Mannerist painting that stretches the rules of classicism to breaking point, global warming has stretched our world to breaking point. Human beings lack a world for a very good reason. This is simply because no entity at all has a world, or, as Graham Harman puts it, there is no such thing as a horizon. The world, as a significant totality, as the significant totality of what is the case, is strictly unimaginable, and for a good reason. It doesn't exist. What is left if we aren't the world? That the song that didn't get sung in the 80s. We aren't the world. Intimacy. We have lost the world but gained a soul, as it were. The entities that coexist with us obtrude on our awareness with greater and greater urgency. The Heidegger in me wants to say that it's precisely the magical amazement of things like stones, beetles, doors, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Nirvana, Bob Geldof, quasars, and cartoon characters in the shape of Richard Nixon's head that are truly what has to be explained, not explained away. Three cheers for the so-called end of the world, then, since this moment is the beginning of history, the end of the human dream that reality is significant for them alone. The prospect of forging new alliances between humans and non-humans alike, now that we have stepped out of the cocoon of world. In 1984, Derek Parfit published the groundbreaking Reasons and Persons, a book that exploded long-held prejudices about utility and ethics from within utilitarianism itself. Parfit's main reason for writing the book was the existence of phenomena such as nuclear radiation and pollution, hyperobjects. What to do about them? Since no one meaningfully related to me will be living 24,100 years from now, the half-life of plutonium, my disposition, cognitive, ethical, political, towards plutonium, must transcend my self-interest, however widely defined. Moreover, hyperobjects last so long that utilitarian concepts such as the social discount rate cannot be ethically or even meaningfully applied to them. Hyperobjects compel us willy-nilly to adopt attitudes for which humans are not well prepared in an age of advanced consumer capitalism. Hyperobjects are messages in bottles from the future. They don't quite exist in a present, for they evacuate the idea of present time, of standard reference points. Their timescale is so much vaster than human lives or human societies that have existed thus far. In order to cope with hyperobjects, we require theories of ethics that are based on scales and scopes that hugely transcend normative self-interest theories, even when we modify self-interest by many orders of magnitude to include several generations down the line or all existing life forms on Earth. In transcending self-interest theories, we need not throw the baby of intimacy out with the bathwater of self. Quite the opposite, in fact. Dropping self-interest theory immediately involves us in what Parfit himself refers to as a more intimate contact with other life forms and with future selves. In a moving passage in the very middle of Reasons and Persons, a passage that is startlingly personal compared with the blisteringly rational mode of Oxbridge utilitarianism that his work exemplifies, Parfit writes, "Is the truth of no self depressing? Some may find it so, but I find it liberating and consoling. When I believe that my existence was a deep further fact, distinct from physical and psychological continuity, and a fact that must be all or nothing, I seemed imprisoned in myself. My life seemed like a glass tunnel through which I was moving faster every year, and at the end of which there was darkness. When I changed my view, the walls of my glass tunnel disappeared. I now live in the open air. There is still a difference between my life and the lives of other people, but that difference is less. Other people are closer. I am less concerned about the rest of my own life and more concerned about the lives of others." Parfit's words themselves exemplify the intimacy and openness to the future that a no-self view bestows. The no-self view is not a faceless, dehumanized abstraction, but a radical encounter with intimacy. What best explains ecological awareness is a sense of intimacy, not a sense of belonging to something bigger, a sense of being close, perhaps even too close to other life forms, of having them under one's skin. Hyperobjects force us into an intimacy with our own death because they are toxic, with others because everyone is affected by them, and with the future because they are massively distributed in time. Attuning ourselves to the intimacy that hyperobjects demand is not easy. As well as being about mind-bending timescales and spatial scales, hyperobjects do something still more disturbing to our conceptual frames of reference. Hyperobjects undermine normative ideas of what an object is in the first place. This sudden turnaround has an uncanny effect. Knowledge about radiation makes us question commonsensical ideas about the utility and benefits of the sun. Unlike sunlight, we can't directly see radiation, yet it affects us far more intensely than visible light. Knowledge about ozone depletion, global warming, and radiation have turned ordinary reality into a dangerous place that Ulrich Beck calls risk society, a place in which government policy now involves the distribution of risk across populations, often unevenly. In the long run, no one is exempt from risk. Once we become aware of long-term effects of hyperobjects, we can't abolish this awareness, and so it corrodes our ability to make firm decisions in the present. The fact that we need devices such as computers and Geiger counters to see hyperobjects, objects that will define our future, is humbling in the same way that Copernicus and Galileo brought humans down to Earth by insisting that the universe was not rotating around us. In their era, common sense, Palin's favourite phrase, right? Common sense told people that the sun revolved around the Earth once a day. Common sense also assured people that weird old ladies who proffered herbal remedies and failed to drown when thrown in water should be burnt because they were witches. Common sense has a lot to answer for. The problem of human society, wrote Jacques Lacan, is what to do with one's own shit. This is, of course, a rather anthropocentric way of putting it. Many non-humans also appear concerned about what to do with their shit. Hyperobjects present us with the same problem, hugely amplified. A styrofoam cup will take about 500 years to biodegrade. Even the massive density of human population itself could be seen as a hyperobject created by technological leaps in agriculture since 1945. What to do about substances that will be around many centuries after our culture has either radically changed or disappeared entirely? The nuclear guardianship movement proposes that radioactive materials such as plutonium, be stored in above-ground, monitored retrievable storage where they are visible and where our decision to have created and used them is in full view, rather than being swept underground or out to sea. It seems highly likely that something like a spiritual culture will emerge around hyperobjects. Accepting this idea does not necessarily imply accepting the need for a secretive atomic priesthood that would prevent others from knowing the truth. The attempt to care for hyperobjects and for their distant future guardians will strikingly change how humans think about themselves and their relationships with non-humans. This change will be a symptom of a gradually emerging ecological theory and practice that includes social policy, ethics, spirituality and art, as well as science. Hyperobjects pose problems for self-interest theory that resemble the problems outlined by the prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma is briefly stated as follows. What would a person do if he or she were a prisoner who was given the choice of remaining silent or betraying another suspect, supposing the following to be the case? 1. If you both betray each other, you will receive 5 years in jail. 2. If one of you betrays and the other one is silent, the betrayed one will receive 10 years in jail. 3. If you both remain silent, you will each get 6 months for a minor charge. Derek Parfit subjects an astonishing array of self-interest theories, variously modified to include relatives, friends, neighbours, descendants, and so on, to numerous tests based on the prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma encourages one to think about how change begins. One thinks of the other. One brings the other into decisions that are supposedly about oneself. To this extent, the prisoner's dilemma is formally collectivist, even though it lacks a positive collectivist or socialist content. The kinds of compromise enforced by the prisoner's dilemma may strike ideological purists as weak. It is precisely this weakness that makes the so-called compromises workable and just. Imagine a future self with interests so different from one's own that to some extent she or he constitutes a different self. Not a reincarnation or someone else, you yourself. This person in the future is like the prisoner being interrogated in the other room. The future self is thus unimaginably distant in one sense, and yet hyperobjects have brought her into the adjoining prison cell. She is strange, yet intimate. The best course of action is to act with regard to her. This radical letting go of what constitutes a self has become necessary because of hyperobjects. The ethics that can handle hyperobjects is directed towards the unknown and unknowable future. When we can see that far into the future and that far around Earth, a curious blindness afflicts us, a blindness far more mysterious than simple lack of sight, since we can precisely see so much more than ever. This blindness is a symptom of an already existing intimacy with all life forms, knowledge of which is now thrust upon us, whether we like it or not. To this extent, we are now in a position to realize that everything is a hyperobject. What we need is an ethics based on the proximity of the stranger. The decision in the 1990s, rapidly overturned, thank goodness, to squirrel plutonium away into knives and forks and other domestic objects, appears monstrous. And so perhaps would any attempt to work it into something convenient. Hyperobjects insist that we care for them in the open. Out of sight, out of mind, is strictly untenable. There is no a way to which to throw plutonium. We are stuck with it in the same way as we are stuck with our biological bodies. Plutonium finds itself in the position of the neighbour in Abrahamic religions, that awkward place of alien and intimate at the very same time. Now, there's lots of individual hyper art objects that I could talk about now, but I'm only going to focus on one. The suppression of contemplative practices in the West is readily discernible in the history of religious interference with music. It's significant that Pope Gregory, who developed rules for sacred music, banned the augmented fourth, the infamous Diabola in Musica, Diabolus in Musica. The augmented fourth chord is considered sacred in Hindu music precisely because it allows the ear to access a vast range of harmonics, a range that evokes a hugely expanded sense of what in musical language is called timbre, the material that generates a sound, such as the wooden strings and open body of a sitar. And I can't believe that I've got a picture of Mr. Jethro Tull up there doing the one-legged flute dance. I actually can't believe that I've got that, but there you go. The difference between a flute and a sitar, one's made of wood with strings, the other one's made of metal. That's what you hear when you hear that flute sound, right? You hear the metal. You hear the wood of the sitar. What resonates in just intonation, for example, music based on whole number harmonic intervals, such as Indian music, is a profound range of substantiality. The singing of Sanskrit syllables, such as Om, a sound that Hinduism and Buddhism associate with the substantial universe as such, evokes the materiality of the singing body and of the breath that circulates within and outside that body while it remains alive. These syllables are made to vibrate with as subtle and as profound a range of harmonics as possible, evoking the vastness of the universe. Devotional singing, then, is a form of hyperobject, one that meets the intimacy with the other and with the far distant future that hyperobjects such as plutonium force upon us. We discover in the contemplative singing practices of India an expanded materialism that tunes the singer and the listener to the precise timbre of the voice and the body and to the resonant frequencies of the ambience in which the music is played. This materialism is designed precisely to bring the gods to mind. To achieve the intimacy of devotion, bhakti, that is also practiced in esoteric Buddhism. The New York composer Lamont Young, one of John Cage's pupils, stumbled upon the notion of attending to objects in a contemplative way almost by accident when he sought a radical break with Western music in the early 1960s. Young decided that the only way to evoke a truly new music was to stop the narrative flow that is normative in Western music, to pull the emergency brake and bring to a shuddering halt the predictable journeys around the world of diatonic harmony and equal temperament. Young's interest in tones began with a fascination with the sound of the transformer in his Turtles Aquarium, the hum of the electrics that kept the environment habitable, hence 5865, Day of the Antler from the Obsidian Ocelot, the sawmill and the blue sawtooth high-tension line step-down transformer, refracting the legend of the dream of the tortoise, traversing the 189/98 lost ancestral lake region, illuminating quotients from the black tiger tapestries of the drone of the holy numbers. A kind of hypertitle, full of objects. In the sonic space, Young's partner Marianne Zazila's calligraphy begins to reveal the tracery of unmeaning that language supposedly transcends. Zazila places writing in structures that employ a fourfold bilateral symmetry, turning script into illegible arabesque that it already is. These fractal squiggles, reminiscent of sound waves seen on oscilloscopes, mark the performance space, illumined with magenta and blue lights that clash in a way analogous to the way in which notes in an augmented fourth clash, producing a supersaturated abundance of radiation. Lamont Young's and Marianne Zazila's work perform what some philosophy calls Stimmung, attunement, which is precisely the way in which the mind becomes congruent with an object. So now, if you could possibly hit play, because I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. If you could just click the speaker symbol, find the speaker symbol, just click that.
Un peu travaillé aussi dans le fait de passer des conférences scientifiques à la radio. Mais vous sentez que de ce côté, eh bien, on n'a pas besoin d'une conférence de critique comme celle que je vais faire aujourd'hui. La radio, telle qu'elle est présentée à peu près quotidiennement, a une autocritique. Elle a une autocritique parce que tout le monde l'entend, parce que dans le monde entier, on ne sait pas, évidemment, si le conférencier ne trouvera pas quelqu'un qui le majeure, pour le dire, une autocritique, même dans les sphères de la radio, dans l'administration de la radio. Ce n'est pas pour rien que la radio a fait des conférences de parodie où elle se moque d'elle-même. C'est une bonne chose. Il faudrait peut-être un peu généraliser ces conférences d'auto-parodie, si je puis m'exprimer ainsi. Alors, je crois que de ce côté, vous n'avez pas besoin que je vous présente des thèmes usés, et je crois que c'est pas là-dessus qu'il nous faut discuter. Nous n'allons pas transformer cette pauvre heure que nous avons entre nous en une conférence de mise au point des possibilités scientifiques, des possibilités esthétiques même, ou même des possibilités de divertissement. Il faut bien évidemment rire, et il y a l'heure pour tout. Par conséquent, et faire rire, amuser, divertir, c'est là aussi une fonction de la radio, mais je crois qu'elle était suffisamment analysée. Elle est peut-être mise en pratique, puisque je fais de la psychanalyse d'une manière quelquefois intempérante. Il semblerait évidemment que l'univers est constamment occupé à se divertir. Eh bien, je crois qu'il faut...